Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Nonfiction, where in reality, we discuss relevant topics of the past and the present. I'm your host, The Communicator. Our show today is Veterans Voices, Segment 2, of our ongoing audio documentation of the plight of those of us who served our country and are currently dealing with day-to-day trials and tribulations of civilian life. Our guest is Lone Swanier, a U.S. Navy vet. Welcome, Lone, to Nonfiction.
Thank you, Mr. Batista, or Robert, as you like to be called. Thank you.
You're welcome, and it's a pleasure, and I want to thank you so much for being a part of Veterans Voices and coming on. So, Lone, you are a veteran of the U.S. Armed Services, specifically the Navy. What does this exactly mean to you?
That is a good question, and first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on your show. I'm very honored, and I don't take this lightly. Being a Navy veteran means a few things to me. As I look back at just the fact that I was able to serve. Some people are not afforded the opportunity to serve in their country, so I consider that to be an honor to serve. Very thankful that I was able to serve our country honorably. And just the contributions that I was able to give and still give after getting out. And it has provided a lot of benefits to me and my family by serving in the military, which I was able to complete some education. I was able to obtain my bachelor's degree and my master's degree. So I'm very thankful for that. Due to my disabilities, I'm able to receive a monetary compensation. So that helps me as well, another source of income. So those are just a few things that when I think about my service, those are the things I think about.
So let's delve into your military career. At what point in your life did you join the Navy? And what were the circumstances that caused you to enlist?
I joined the military when I was 30. So I was kind of what you may call a late bloomer. The reason for me wanting to join at that time was more so a financial reasons. I had three children at the time. I was a single parent. And while I was employed, gainfully employed, I needed something to give me a boost where I could, work and also get education, and I wouldn't have to pay a lot of these things out of my pocket. So I started to do my research, and from there I just decided that going into the military, although it would be hard because, like I said, I already had children, they were minor children, and so but I took all that into account and decided that that's what I was going to do. I was going to head and join, go on active duty.
I'm just a little curious. You had your choice of all the branches, including the Coast Guard and the Air Force and the Army and even the Marine Corps. Why did you pick the Navy, or did the Navy pick you?
I picked the Navy. Actually, Navy wasn't my first choice. I wanted to go Air Force. It was actually a gentleman that did my taxes that spoke highly of women in the military. And it really was his, the things that he shared with me about how well women do in the military that made me really explore it some more. And so when it came down to choosing the branch of service I would go into, because I had children, it was a little bit more hoops I would have to go through for the Air Force and the Navy. It wasn't, they didn't have, such strict rules. So I opted to go with the Navy.
Give us a little background on your Navy career. How long were you in, and where did you serve?
Okay, I served 5 years, or as some people like to spell it all out, 5 years, 1 month, and 24 days. I did my basic training in Great Lakes, Illinois, and from there
I was saying up by Chanute, I think around there in Illinois.
Close. It's about maybe, I don't know if it's like 45 minutes from the city, Chicago. I'm not sure of the city that you're referring to. It could be. I'm not familiar with that city.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's fine. That's fine. And so from there, I was given orders to go to Bremerton, Washington, and I was stationed to the USS Rainier AOE-7. It's a supply ship, and so we refueled other ships and supply cargo. So with that being said, pretty much deployed, we were always, as they say, haze gray in a way. So I didn't see my family much. The ship, they decommissioned the ship shortly after I was on there, maybe a year after I was on the ship, and they turned it into a USNS ship. And so I got orders to go to school. It was called Legalman A School in Rhode Island, and I studied paralegal studies there. And then from there, I went back to Great Lakes, and I worked at Naval Station Great Lakes, and I worked with the JAG in the Admiral Building there. And I finished up my time there. My career ended there, but I worked in the defense office, and then I also worked in a legal assistance office. And then that was pretty much, you know, I had some health issues, and I was medically retired out of the military.
Yeah, I was asking if it was near Chanute. I was in the Air Force, and we had an Air Force base up by the Great Lakes called Chanute Air Force Base. So I was just wondering if you knew about that. But so that's amazing what you just said. Mm-hmm. I know, Lene, you served on a ship for a period of time. How was that experience?
The experience for me has its pros and cons.
Right.
For me, it was really tough, for one, just being away. Like I said, we were always deployed in on the ship. When you're out to sea, you just can't stop and get off. So you're out, you're away from your family. You don't have the luxury of good food. At least I didn't, in my experience.
Right.
I slept in close quarters with other females, and that took some getting used to. And even in our sleeping quarters, the bed area is not like you would, a bed at home. It looks like a coffin, and it's just a little small area that you have to crawl in, and there's like, three bunks, we'll say, six in an area. So it's a lot. It's a lot of women in one area, really close quarters, and it was pretty tough being away for me, being away from my family. But the good part was I made good use of my time. I studied more about the military. They have a certain pins that you can earn. So I studied and had to take two boards. You had to go through one board. If you pass that, you go through another board. And I passed both boards, and then they have a pinning ceremony. So things like that made my time go better, because I made good use of my time. I don't like to waste my time or feel like my time is being wasted. So I knew my family was good. My children were with my husband. So I knew that they were in good hands. So I just tried to, change my focus while I was out to sea and just do the best job that I could do and learn as much as I could learn.
Sounds like it was time well spent for you. So, you know, Lene,
yes.
Around the time you were scheduled to get out of the service, you were diagnosed with an ailment. Can you explain what these circumstances were?
Yes. During the time that I got out, it was my I was getting near the end of my contract to get out, but they needed someone to deploy to Afghanistan, and so they said that I would be going to Afghanistan, and I had to go for a medical clearance, and I went through the medical clearance, and but I was having some vision, some problems with my eyes, and I said, let me go get my eyes checked before I deploy, and so I went to the ophthalmologist on base, and the doctor was checking my eyes, and then he called in for another doctor, and they're both checking my eyes, and they asked me, have I ever heard of sarcoidosis? Well, at the time, I couldn't even pronounce the word. I said, no. And they were asking me, does lighting bother my eyes? And I said, no, all I see is like floaters. So long story short, they said, we're going to have to get in touch with your primary care doctor because it appears that you may have sarcoidosis. And so I had a series of tests done, and then I had to have a surgery done to rule out cancer, and the surgeon came back and said, yes, I do have sarcoidosis, but I don't have cancer, but that stopped my career, so I couldn't go further. If I wanted to enlist, they would not let me enlist. And so sarcoidosis is an inflammatory disease. It's characterized by inflammation. Inflammatory cells, they're called granulomas. And symptoms that some people may experience are shortness of breath, persistent dry cough, wheezing, red eyes or vision problems, like I mentioned, skin rashes, joint pain, and there's several other ailments a person may have. They call sarcoidosis the mystery disease because they don't know why people get it. And as far as the last I know, they don't have a cure for it. There are some people that famous that you know you may all know that that had sarcoidosis. Reggie White, he's passed away. Bernie
right.
Mac, the comedian, he had it, and I think the a singer Angie Stone, I believe she has it. So.
Okay.
So
how's that for you now? I mean, are you still going through that? I know you said it was incurable. Is it still affecting you the way it was back then, or is that better for you?
It's been a lot better for me now, and the last time I checked was last year, and the doctor told me that it's in remission. So I haven't had any problems since that first flare-up, and so thankfully I haven't had any problems from it.
Thank God for that. You know, Lene,
yes.
After you separated from the Navy and became a civilian again, how was that transition for you mentally?
It was stressful for me as I was getting out the military because, my husband had just had a hip replacement. And, he used to work for a moving company. And when he worked for a moving company, he was putting some stuff on the truck. And as he was coming down, bringing some stuff off the truck, he lost his balance and fell and broke his hip. And he would get hip injections, I think they call steroid injections or cortisone injections for a number of years until the doctor said that it's bone on bone. We have to do surgery. So, they had to do surgery for him, and so it was like I'm dealing with that. I'm dealing with my health issues. We have small children. I mean, by this time, they're like middle school age, but then it's, the thought of, where am I going to work at? You know, I have my military career, but does it transition into civilian world? And
right.
What I found for me was when I got out and was looking for paralegal jobs, I didn't have a civilian paralegal degree or anything. I had what the military provided me, but it didn't, in my case, I can't speak for everybody, it didn't transition into the civilian sector, like private practices and things of that nature. So once I got that, you know, kind of figured out that it's just not going to work, I started kind of went a different direction. So it was pretty tough. It was pretty stressful at first.
What was the transitional process that the Navy had for you to assist you in separating? Did they have any programs or workshops for you to attend to prepare you to leave?
The military did have an out-processing. I'm sorry, I can't remember what it's called now, but they
right.
did help you if you wanted resume writing or if you needed help with like mock interviews to prepare you for interviews. And I think it may have been just like a one-day class, if I can remember. I guessing it was somewhat helpful, but it, you know, didn't help me totally. You know, it didn't help me totally. I had to figure a lot of stuff out on my own once I got out.
And how was the housing situation? I know a few veterans have told me that once they separated, being that the housing market is so crazy, you know, they had a hard time finding decent housing and affordable housing. How was that for you?
Well, what I did was, I don't know that this was wise, but it worked out for me. When I was going through the medical boarding process, I started looking for houses then.
Okay.
So I, like I said, I was in Illinois. I'm now in the Nashville, Tennessee area. So I looked online and did a lot of stuff online because my command wouldn't release me because they were already short-staffed. They don't have a lot of employees, as you would think, and because my rating or my job, there's only so many paralegals, and so there was only just myself and another one, and they didn't want to lose me, even though that they knew I was going. They gave me a hard time about leaving. So anyway, I did a lot of stuff online, and then my husband would go and came and looked at the houses in person. And so I just purchased a house, and I knew that I was getting out, but I just didn't tell them that. And so I had my military pay and all of that. And so
right.
I really honestly took a step of faith by doing that. So I secured, you know, I was able to purchase a home prior to getting out, and so that's how I did it. Now, like I said, I don't know that that's wise for other people to do it, but I did it that way because a friend that I had made that was she was in the military but was then a civilian, said that when her and her husband got out of the military and then they tried to find a house, starting all over again, starting a new job, it was hard for them to do that. So that
right.
just stuck in my mind, that thought, well, maybe I'll get a house while I'm still on active duty, you know, and I'll have, you know, proof that I'm working, and it will work out in my favor that way. So that's what I ended up doing. I just ended up getting a house while I was on active duty.
Yeah, that's really, really good that foresight that you had worked out for you. I know, Lene,
yes.
that you got employment, of course, after you were separated and left the service. What type of jobs did you get afterwards leading up to the job that you have now?
Well, I worked, I did work some jobs through the temp agency, some
okay.
factories, I would say maybe for a period of maybe 3 months. And then I started working for the state of Tennessee. I worked with them for a year. It was just a temporary position, filling a slot for someone that was out on a medical leave. And then the economy just took a tank, and that position, they removed that position. And I started doing security, unarmed security guard work. And
right.
then I got my foot into the Internal Revenue Service, into the federal system. And then I just kind of went from there. So I had to work, you know, little jobs here or there, just so I could pay my mortgage and
sure,
other bills.
Sure. Getting that foot in the door at the IRS, did you have to take an exam to get in?
No, they didn't have an exam. They, what I did was they had, you had to fill out an application back then. I guess they don't, anyway, things have changed how they do things nowadays. Everything so is electronic. But at any rate, they had whoever they selected were looking to pull the people. They had us come in and they did, I guess you call it mock interviews or telephone calls. We, because I was taking a position in a call center, they
right.
had the employees there that would test you on answering, how you answer the phone, and they gave you scenarios of people were calling with made-up tax problems, and they had liens or levies, and so you would have to answer the best you could. They knew that you probably didn't know the answer, but they just wanted to see how you did from there. And so after getting called in to do those a couple of times, then I was hired on, but they didn't have any written exam or anything
okay.
of that nature.
After you left the service, did you remain in contact with anyone you had served with any other veterans?
I did. There were a few people that I did keep in contact with. Yes, sir.
I know you now work for the VA. On your job, do you interact at all with veterans?
Yes, pretty much on a daily basis. So my job, I am a field examiner. That's my title. And I work for the fiduciary hub out of the Louisville, Kentucky office. And there's more than just that one hub, but that's the fiduciary hub that I work for. My job is totally remote. Meaning that I don't go into an office. I work out of my home, and then
right.
I go out in the field to see veterans and beneficiaries. The people that come into the program have either a mental disability or a physical disability, and my job is to find someone that I believe is suitable to make sure the veteran, or in a lot of cases, a surviving spouse, widows, that their money is being used properly for them, for their housing, for, you know, the things that they need, their everyday needs. And so I come in contact with veterans almost on a daily basis.
Knowing about Veterans Affairs, can you tell us what, to you, are some of the problems and concerns that vets are having in today's society?
Some of the common things that I run across are some veterans are having problems with housing. I think probably the top thing that really comes to mind are mental issues.
Right.
A lot of them are dealing with a lot of mental issues, and I feel, you know, I don't know the data, so I can't speak to that, but I think some of them are being pushed to the system or some are being overlooked. And I think that is something that needs to be looked at a little bit more because,
right.
like I said, I deal with a lot of veterans, and I don't work on the medical side of the house. But when I'm dealing with people, I look at the person and, you know, I definitely want to show empathy and not say, well, that's not my job, but try to get them the help that they need. But a lot of them, it's their mental. It's a lot of, you know, people, they're suicidal. I just feel like there's just not enough that can be done with that. And I feel like sometimes veterans and people in general, but I know we're talking about veterans, can be pushed aside because of their mental. And some people don't even want to admit that they have a mental illness or mental issues because of the stigma behind that.
Yeah, it's a terrible stigma. You're right.
Yes, it is.
You know, Lene, you can go on the streets of any big city and notice that many veterans are struggling with a myriad of issues, as we talked about, such as homelessness, drug abuse and unemployment. It's almost like the leaders of our country have turned their backs to those who serve and put their lives on the line. Is this something that you've noticed as well?
Yes, I have noticed this in my job that I do, and just, you know, because I, you know, I live and I see things, you know.
Right.
There's, you know, so many times where there's veterans that, you know, to me are dirt deserving of more help that just don't get it. And sometimes I will hear from surviving spouses, their children, their adult children will say, you know, my mom is only getting $1,000. She should get more. And I tell them, you know, there's veterans out there that don't get anything. And that's the God honest truth. You know, there's some veterans that make it $60 a month, some that don't get anything, some that, you know, can't even get adequate housing, adequate medical care. So, yeah, I see it, and I just hope that they can do more to help in that area.
Yeah. Do you know if female veterans have a separate array of issues, any different sort of problems that they deal with?
That is a very good question. I'm sure there are some differences, but I don't know of anything that stands out that are different, because I deal with female veterans that have some of the same exact issues with, you know, their mental illness. Some feel like the VA doesn't do enough to help them, housing issues, things of that nature. So, like I said, there could be more that there could be other things that, you know, females deal with than men. I don't know. There's a lot of people that talk about sexual trauma, but there's men that have went through that too. So I don't know that there's a difference or not. You know, sometimes women talk about it more, but sometimes they don't, you know, because again, there's the shame, the stigma, you know, behind that, you know.
So if you could wave a magic wand and seriously help the plight of veterans, what would be the first thing you would do?
I think I would fix the mental, what I talked about, the mental illness crisis.
Right.
I don't know exactly how I would go about it, but that right there, there needs to be a change with how they handle people that are mentally ill. Like I said, in the job that I do, even though I'm looking at their finances and things of that nature, I've had veterans call me crying for other unrelated issues, just knowing that they have a person that they can call, my cell phone number, get me on the phone, and know that I'm going to listen, means the world to them. And so some of these things that these people that they go through, I've had to reach out to social workers and say, hey, you know, this is going on with this person, you know, can we do something about getting him help? You know, I know he's been there before for whatever reason, you know, but this person is really crying out for help, and I am limited in what I can do for them, rather than just pushing to the side, you know, they're just kind of just pushing to the side. And that's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate to see that happen. Because I have seen that happen before. So I'd like to start there with the mental illness.
I understand that the VA just held a Women's Veterans Virtual Outreach Symposium where they went over resources tailored for women vets. How important is something like this? And do you think this should be a regular occurrence for female veterans?
I think that's definitely a step in the right direction, to have a platform like that where women can have resources that they can, you know, have afforded to them, and a point of contact of people that they can reach out to for their specific needs as a female. And I think that should be reoccurring. I don't think that should just be a one-time thing. I think that
right.
They should do that more often. Yeah, they definitely should do that more often. And I don't know if they're doing it for men, but that's definitely a great step. in the right direction. And it also brings about trust because a lot of people don't trust the VA. You know, I hear that as well. A lot of people don't trust the VA.
Yeah, that trust is extremely important. Lene, in closing, if a young female member of your family told you she is considering joining the Navy, what advice would you give her?
Wow, that's a good question as well. I would definitely have them do their research to figure out what it is that they want to do in the military, to know, you know, so they know, you know, what direction they want to go into, what job they want to go to do. Certain jobs have required that you get a certain score on your ASVAB, so you want to make sure that, you know all this going into it, and look at the totality of it. Some people go into, for instance, the Navy, thinking that they're not going to go on a ship. Some people don't ever go on a ship. Some people never deploy. But you want to look at all of those things. So, and to utilize me as a resource, and if anybody else that I know that could, I could reach, you know, get them in contact with, would get them in contact with. So that's, you know, a big thing. Do your research. Know why you're doing what you're doing. You know, to make a, you know, make a good sound decision before you go in.
That's great advice. Thank you. You've been listening to a new and exciting concept in podcasting called Nonfiction. Today's show is dedicated to all those who served, helping them in any way possible, Veterans Voices. And our most articulate guest has been Lene Swanier. Thank you so much, Lene, for coming on the show.
Thank you, Robert, for having me. I had fun.
It was wonderful. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. You as well.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.